Thanks, Wally. The time we worked together was really wonderful. He's a man of great character and integrity. Today, being a professor, I had to have a title for a talk with a colon in it, of course, and I called it Cracks in the Empire, George Bush, Iraq, and the World. And this really comes out of a few different motivating factors. A couple months ago, before this began, I was deeply bleak. I mean, I was just felt horrible because I thought, you know, they're going to pull this off. It's going to be a 72-hour war, and then they're going to go into Syria and Iran, and it's just going to be this new, you know, kind of imperium, the Roman Empire writ large. And I was really terrified because obviously the Bush junta, you know, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, the usual suspects, don't really care about what the world thinks, and that was quite evident. But now, 2 months later, after the hostilities have essentially ceased, I'm actually far more hopeful. And this optimism does come out of a very tragic event, the massacre of who knows how many thousands of people and the destruction of a very old civilization. But at the same time, I think we have a set of factors in the world which could potentially lead to a realignment in world politics and a better place for all of us. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. The irony of this is that it's kind of a very conservative argument. We often read, you know, all great sources, The Nation and Alex Coburn and Noam Chomsky and people like that. Unfortunately, we're not the folks who have power. And as this war progressed, what kept, you know, kind of striking me was that if I were a conservative, if I were part of the ruling elite, I would really want to strangle George Bush because he's essentially done very deep harm to my interest. And as Wally said, the first book I did on Vietnam was actually about that. What I discovered was that the military was opposed to the Vietnam War. And so that's always fascinated me, the idea that the ruling class has fissures and cracks in it. And writ large, when you look at the world, I think Bush has really demonstrated some deep cracks in the empire, which do create openings. What's going to come of them, I don't know. My predictive powers have never been terribly good in the past. I'm not sure my analytical powers are that good, but we're going to give it a shot. So that's what I want to talk about. And I want to start with a couple quotes from sources which may seem unusual, but they're two people who I actually really appreciate. And the first was a fairly well-known American who was giving a 4th of July oration in 1821. And he said, "America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. She will command the general cause by the countenance of her voice and the benign sympathy of her example. She well knows that by once enlisting under other banners than her own, were they even the banners of foreign independence, she would involve herself beyond the power of extrication in all the wars of interest and intrigue, of individual avarice, envy, and ambition, which assume the colors and usurp the standards of freedom. The fundamental maxims of her policy would insensibly change from liberty into force. She might become the dictatress of the world. She would no longer be the ruler of her own spirit." That was on the 4th of July in 1821. Later, in 1948, the United States passed a law called the National Security Act, ushering what many of us refer to as the national security state. And a very influential senator spoke against it. And he said, "The United States is now about to become an imperial country, which will take, quote, a provocative stand on every controversial issue and attack every country in the world." This senator continued, "Our fingers will be in every pie. Our military forces will work with our commercial forces to obtain as much of world trade as we can lay our hands on. We will occupy all the strong strategic points in the world and try to maintain a force so preponderant that none shall dare attack us. Potential power over other nations, however benevolent conceived its purposes, leads inevitably into imperialism." Now, one might think those statements came from Henry Wallace or George McGovern or someone like that. The first was John Quincy Adams, one of the greatest expansionists in American history. The second was a man who was called Mr. Conservative. He was a senator from Ohio named Robert Taft. Two of the more conservative people in American political tradition spoke forcefully about American empire, American aggression, and American expansion. And in 2003, those words ring more powerfully than they ever did before. And I think that what we're seeing now is essentially kind of a critique of empire that we haven't. I mean, Americans essentially are in denial about that. We don't have a class system. We're not an imperial country. Well, people are finally taking a reckoning of that. And so that's what I want to talk about. And the overriding theme I see coming out of this, put very simply, is that the Bush administration, and when I say the Bush administration, I'm essentially excluding George Bush. The line I always use is Bush is essentially the monkey and the other people are the organ grinders. And so I'm talking about Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and folks like that, because Bush is off, you know, doing his exercise bike and praying and whatnot. So when I refer to him, I'm just doing it kind of as kind of a generic thing, because he's obviously not the brains of this operation. Is the line Scott, my dear friend Scott, always uses, there aren't any brains in this operation. And I think it's from a movie, and I think that's really appropriate here. So simply put, the Bush administration has undermined American prestige, damaged American interest, hurt American credibility in ways which were unimaginable in the post-war era, and especially in the aftermath of 9/11. After 9/11, American imperialism was at its highest. I said, you know, I remember that day saying they can do anything they want and get away with it. Bush somehow has managed to screw that up, which is a monumental blunder and a monumental achievement at the same time, and it's really quite remarkable. And it just shows, you know, despite the hubris and all these great talks of success that we're hearing in the American media, the rest of the world doesn't look at it that way. We're truly isolated. I spend way too much of my time reading papers from all over the world, the Middle East and Europe and Asia. And the American press is the only media presenting the war the way it does. No one else sees it that way, and no one else is getting the same kind of limited, sanitized information that we're receiving from the Times and Post and other sources like that. What I found, which is even more striking, and in the long term quite both disturbing yet also potentially a source of progress, is that the Bush administration has essentially abandoned, left behind, the globalizing mission that has characterized American foreign affairs. Now, the movement that emerged to challenge this war globally, and it was far more potent and effective elsewhere than it was in the U.S., essentially emerged out of the anti-globalization movements of the 90s and in the early part of the century. I mean, the heyday would be from, you know, November of 99 in Seattle to September 10th, 2001, when many of us were just, like, for the first time in our lives, actually optimistic that there would be kind of a democratic movement, and then September 11th really kind of, you know, undermined all that. So this globalizing mission, you know, Bush has essentially undermined it. And again, if you're part of the ruling elite, you want to strangle the guy because of that. Okay? The U.S. today remains overwhelmingly the greatest power in the world. There's no doubt about that. However, I think emerging out of the Iraqi war, there's a potential realignment of world politics and a challenge to American imperialism. And this is a good thing. For the first time in, you know, my memory since the Vietnam War ended, I remember in 1975, I was very young, but thinking, the world's different now. The U.S. can't do this kind of stuff anymore. It's learned its lesson. It's been stopped. Well, that obviously wasn't the case. There really wasn't any kind of a Vietnam syndrome. Will there be an Iraqi syndrome? I don't know. But I think there is the possibility of a potential realignment in world affairs that could actually usher in forces of progress, forces of movement, rather than forces of authority and forces of order. And I think that that's potentially a very good thing. Okay? So this is basically a conservative critique of the war. And I want to push three themes, and I'll try to be as brief and glib as I can. The first is that George Bush has undermined international credibility and power in ways that, as I said before, to me at least, are inconceivable. The second is that this war and Bush's behavior has exposed deep fissures, deep problems, deep divisions within what I'll call the ruling class. And essentially, I mean the foreign policy establishment and the military. And the third, which in the long run is, I think, going to be the most important, but at this time we still don't know how it's going to play out, is that the war has unleashed economic forces, which are going to create, I think, a real day of reckoning in the United States. Politically, I'm certainly no analyst or prophet, but there's even a chance that Bush could become vulnerable electorally in ways that his father was, although that would imply that there would be an opposition party to take advantage of it, and I haven't seen that yet. As Gore Vidal says, we have one party with two right wings, so I want to start with an observation by a Financial Times of London reporter. The beauty of this is so much of my information comes from the most conservative presses in the world, Reuters, the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, things like that. This is a Financial Times reporter saying, rather than make the most of the extraordinary support the world offered to the United States after 9/11, the Bush administration seems almost willfully to have squandered it. In the months after September 11th, the administration withdrew from one international agreement after another, from the ABM Treaty to the International Criminal Court. It refused NATO's offer to help in Afghanistan, eventually accepting some troops but no shared NATO decision-making. Though German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder braved a no confidence vote to win parliamentary approval to put German combat troops in Afghanistan, he received no thanks from Bush. Nor was he seriously consulted as Bush formulated his Iraq policy, despite or because of growing signs of German discomfort with that policy. Cut out of the loop, Schroeder then began to exploit the anti-Iraq war backlash among German voters and become a fierce opponent of Bush's war. These kinds of themes become quite prevalent. When I think of Bush, and as I said before, we've kind of been on this globalizing mission. American foreign policy has been characterized by a search for free trade, what American policymakers often call the open door. And that's, you know, really forever, and especially since 1898. And Clinton, who I'm incredibly critical of, was very good at it. He was a very successful president, if you accept the basic precepts of what he was trying to do. He was terribly successful, he and Robert Rubin. Bush has essentially abandoned that. And rather than being kind of free trade imperialists, these guys remind me of kind of 19th century British imperialists. And what they're doing in Iraq right now, I think, is a classic example, like cutting out the rest of the world, occupying and sending in a proconsul, Jay Garner, and so forth. They also remind me of another group of people, and I don't say this to be alarmist or to sound, you know, hyperbolic, but what they're advocating is essentially national socialism as well. Because they're trying to create a closed world, which is essentially what the Germans and the Italians were trying to do in the 30s. They want to set the Middle East off, almost like the British had it after World War I, so that they can control the resources of this region, use it for investment, markets, and so forth. So when I say national socialism, I'm not necessarily referring to, you know, concentration camps or anything like that, but in terms of their kind of corporative outlook on the world, it's very similar to that. So these guys really are, it's kind of ironic, Rumsfeld said that France and Germany were old Europe. Well, in fact, the U.S. and Britain are old Europe. The U.S. and Britain really are kind of retreating into a past world, whereas I think the rest of the Europeans, the rest of the world really kind of understands that the future has to be more multilateral and independent. So first I want to talk a little bit about this concept of how Bush undermines American prestige and power. I've always argued, writing a book on the Cold War right now, that the biggest mistake in American foreign policy history was its China policy after 1949, its refusal to recognize Mao Zedong's government and, you know, the attack on China and so forth, and catastrophic, the biggest country in the world. I think the Iraqi attack, if it plays out the way that it very well could, will surpass that as the biggest blunder, in fact, tragedy in America's foreign policy history. First off, it was an illegal attack. Iraq, I mean, look at the rationale Bush gave. You know, Iraq harbored terrorists. Well, the CIA said that wasn't true. 50-some% of Americans believe that, you know, Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9-1-1. So it kind of shows the power of the media. So that's been undermined. Iraq harbored terrorists that were responsible for 9-1-1. The CIA said that's not true. Iraq was a threat to the United States. That's very easily disproved. Okay, look at the war. Look at the way the war went. I mean, was that a threat? This is a country which essentially folded. This is a country which disarmed before the war. All right? And then, of course, the major excuse was that they had the infamous now WMDs, weapons of mass destruction. Okay? Look at that logically. If you know anything about military doctrine, if a country which poses a potential threat to you has weapons of mass destruction, whether it be nuclear or chemical, why would you wait until March 17th and go through all the kind of formula of taking them out? If this country posed a threat to you and had nuclear or chemical weapons, you would have gone in there on February 5th when Colin Powell announced that he had definitive proof of weapons of mass destruction. If Saddam Hussein, who everybody's been told is an evil dictator, which is absolutely true, to his own people, internationally, Saddam Hussein is one of the most ineffective and incompetent leaders. If Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, why, when George Bush on March 15th announced that he had 48 hours to get out of Dodge, didn't he unleash them? And then the new story we're hearing is that what he did was he destroyed them on the eve of the war. Okay, if you did that, you would be in compliance with the UN. So why wouldn't you tell them? See, the idea behind having weapons of mass destruction and nuclear weapons, it's called deterrence. Deterrence means that you want to deter people from hurting you by being afraid of what you have. The best example of deterrence right now in the world today is in Pyongyang. Kim Jong-il is a nut, right? No, Kim Jong-il is very smart. Because Kim Jong-il is saying, if you mess with me, I'll nuke you. That's deterrence. Saddam Hussein is saying, I don't have any weapons. And he starts destroying his al-Masud missiles and destroying his chemical and biological weapons before the war. Now, that either indicates that the war was illegal, he's the biggest dummy as a military commander in all time, both of which are true, and that the war was simply a war crime. And that's absolutely true as well. There was no legitimate rationale under international law for George Bush to wage this attack. And the rest of the world now recognizes that. And Tony Blair is starting to fret about it. Luckily, Bush won't get pressure here because the media is essentially letting it go. And even more importantly, there's no opposition party to call him on it in Congress. But every rationale these people gave to attack Iraq has been undermined. So it was an illegitimate war. It was a unilateral war, the coalition of the willing. Have you seen the coalition? It's the U.S., the United Kingdom, and major military powers like Micronesia and the Marshall Islands. All right? The United States and the United Kingdom have a combined military budget annually of about $600 billion. Okay? You know, a free Pepsi for anybody who can tell me what Iraq's military budget was last year. $1.4 billion. So they've destroyed all their missiles, they've gotten rid of all their weapons, and they spent $1 billion on weapons. Okay? This would be the equivalent of, like, you know, the New York Yankees playing a local high school team, winning 35-0 and then boasting about it. And it was done without any international sanction. Right? And again, the media kind of went along with that. Resolution 1441, which was passed in November, unanimously, by the way, and remember, Syria voted for that, said that unless Saddam Hussein came into compliance with the UN, then the U.S. had the UN had the possibility, had the option of using force. Now, what's kind of ironic is Bush would later say that we don't need another resolution that gave us the right to do that. But go back and read the papers. John Negroponte, who was one of the thugs behind U.S. Central American policy in the 1980s. He's essentially a war criminal and a contributor to mass murder in Guatemala, El Salvador, and places like that. Negroponte's now the ambassador to the U.N. And after 1441 was voted upon in the fall, Negroponte said, this is a two-phase process. This is not an automatic trigger for war. So Bush's own ambassador admitted that they did not have sanction to go in unilaterally, yet they did it anyway because they couldn't get the votes. All right? I could probably end this right now with a simple statement. The United States failed in the Security Council to get the votes of Cameroon and Guinea. All right? That alone says it all. I mean, what more can you say? In the Security Council, the U.S. couldn't get votes from Cameroon and Guinea, let alone Mexico and Chile. Cameroon and Guinea. I mean, if that isn't the ultimate statement of a lack of prestige and credibility, you know, I mean, all the great, you know, architects of American empire, Dean Acheson and John Foster Dulles and Dwight Eisenhower and John Kennedy and Richard Nixon and Jim Baker and George Shultz would be spinning, you know, because he couldn't get votes from Cameroon and Guinea. I mean, that's just, you know, by itself kind of a prima facie argument that the U.S. has lost its credibility in the world, right? So he alienated the world. He alienated allies. The most, you know, the best example, of course, would be Dominique de Villepin, the French foreign minister, in his statements. And, you know, Colin Powell has vowed revenge upon the French. I'm not sure the French are really shaking in their boots. It's kind of funny. Chirac made a call to Bush, and the CNN and the New York Times said, you know, conciliatory call, hat in hand, and so forth. The American the European press reported it totally differently. I mean, Chirac now has cards that Bush doesn't have. Chirac has credibility in the world that Bush doesn't have. I was jokingly saying to one of my friends, Jacques Chirac has become the Mao Zedong of the 21st century. Mao was a great hero in the Third World for standing up to the U.S. And Chirac, who is, it's kind of a frightening statement on American politics. If Chirac were an American politician, he'd be the left wing of the Democratic Party today. The French, I think, really have kind of played this very cleverly, and so have the Germans and the Russians and even to some extent the Chinese. What you have five permanent members of the Security Council, the U.S., Britain, France, China, and Russia. I still want to say Soviet Union. It's still hard for me to get over that. You had three votes in the Security Council against you, not to mention Cameroon and Guinea, which I can't say enough. So this is, again, a catastrophic blunder, and one which I'll get to in a minute, that Bush had been warned against by just about everybody, including his father and his father's inner circle and Henry Kissinger and most of the Pentagon and the CIA. So he rejected the advice of the wise men of foreign policy. He and these six or eight guys, this, you know, kind of junta, essentially listened to only one another. And I think that, you know, if you go back, and the Internet's full of the statements of people like de Villepin and Joshua Fischer and Gerhard Schroeder and others, and they really kind of laid it out there. You know, there was no real concern that this would be a difficult, bloody war. I mean, that everyone knew that it wouldn't be. And in fact, I would argue militarily it didn't go well. The fact that it took 4 weeks to subdue, you know, an army that didn't fight, which was essentially 10,000 Fedayeen fought because everybody else, you know, kind of laid their weapons down, is not exactly anything to crow about. Even more than that, you know, this thing isn't over yet. When 2,000 Shia appear in Karbala to protest the U.S. and say, you know, thanks for getting rid of Saddam, now get the hell out of town, you have potential problems. If you recall, at one point, the U.S. Army Chief of Staff, Eric Shinseki, got into a very public pissing match with Rumsfeld about the number of occupation troops that would be needed. Shinseki saying it would probably be a couple hundred thousand. Rumsfeld said, oh, no, we're going to clean up. We won't need anything there. And that hasn't been played out yet. There are still, you know, the American forces haven't left Iraq yet. And, you know, there's a good chance that they will be there for a while because, you know, left to their own devices, the Iraqis may try to practice democracy and elect somebody they want. So what's the old, is it Phil Oakes? No, Tom Lehrer. We have to get out until somebody we like can be elected or something like that. So Bush has done that. Bush has alienated Turkey, which I thought was impossible. Turkey turned down $30 billion in aid and aid packages and refused to allow the U.S. to use the North, right? This is going to be interesting now because the Kurds have taken over Kirkuk and Mosul, which has oil, and the Turks obviously treat the Kurds probably worse than Saddam Hussein does, so there's something to play out there. And something else I'm going to talk about later is Bush has alienated the most important transnational institutions in the world, the United Nations, of course. And I don't think the UN has actually, this was the UN's finest hour either, because granted the UN, you know, stood up, but when push came to shove, George Bush said to the UN, I want you to get everybody out of town. I want you to get everybody out of Baghdad. And what did Kofi Annan do? Did Kofi Annan say, I'm the freaking Secretary General of the UN, I'll do what I want, they're staying, Blix is staying? No, everybody got out. So this wasn't the UN's finest hour either. But at the same time, Bush has alienated the UN, he's alienated the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization. So when I say cracks in the empire, I think for the first time within, you know, the past quarter century or so, the major institutions which govern the world, the ruling elite, really has deep divisions. And we're starting to see a unity of purpose among many of these countries which doesn't fit, which isn't consistent with America's larger imperial goals. So first of all, the war was illegal. It was unilateral, and it was done without allies. Something that the media hasn't covered terribly well, and again you'll find it covered elsewhere, is the response in the Arab world. And that's critical, because this is the geographic region that has become a powder keg. You know, obviously, American policy in the Middle East propelled 9-1-1. No offense, but I don't buy into the conspiracy theories that the CIA did it, because that would involve them being able to do something competently and efficiently, and the CIA has never been able to do that. 9-1-1 was the result of American policy in the Middle East. It was the result of having troops in Saudi Arabia. It was the result of the sanctions against Iraq, which killed hundreds of thousands. And I think most importantly, it was the result of the America's broad support of the illegal and brutal repression of the Palestinians by Ariel Sharon. If Bush wants to do regime change against terrorists, he could start in Jerusalem. It was ironic, just a week or two before, about a month before the war began, Saudi Arabia, which is America's ally, some may say America's client in the Middle East, I would never say that, of course, publicly, Prince Faisal said that any unilateral action by the U.S. would constitute an act of aggression. Independent action in this, we don't believe, is good for the United States, Faisal told the BBC. Okay. Reporting from Riyadh, a newspaper man from Europe who was working for an Arab press, and this is quite long, but it's worth listening to, talked about Saudi Arabia. And again, remember, this is America's best ally in the region. Virtually everyone, both rulers and ruled, in this now viscerally anti-American country. Remember, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi. All right? The U.S. attacked Afghanistan in order to get back at Saudi hijackers who were living in Miami. I was all for attacking Miami, but get the Cubans, you get Al Qaeda, and you know, tacky tourists and everything. Anyway, virtually everyone, both rulers and ruled. I'm on a roll now. I kind of feel like Rodney Dangerfield or somebody like that. In this now viscerally anti-American country, fear what America has in store for it. The war in Iraq has only brought the fear to a new pitch of intensity. But the ruler's response to the war is profoundly, dangerously different from what most of the ruled, the so-called Arab street, would have liked. The government has sought, as far as it dares, to placate the superpower of whose protection it is no longer confident, yet cannot risk forfeiting. It's kind of a codependency kind of thing. I think Dr. Phil could talk about that. So it is that while no U.S. aircraft take off from the Saudi territory on combat missions, the command and control center at Prince Sultan Air Base near Riyadh effectively directs the air war. It is the culmination of the deference since 9/11, Saudi Arabia has exhibited toward the U.S., submitting to pressures for cultural reform in such sensitive areas as hate-breeding religious textbooks, urging a more tolerant discourse on a ferociously orthodox clergy, or promoting the most accommodating Middle East peace initiative ever. The Jordan Times similarly reported after the war had begun. And this, again, continuing this theme of kind of the Arab world's response to this. And the U.S., you know, it's kind of ironic. The U.S. thought it was going to march into Baghdad. And the image I kept having was German soldiers going to Austria in 1936. And the Austrians were putting, you know, flowers, you know, throwing flowers at the German soldiers. And people in the Pentagon actually had deluded themselves that this would happen. The U.S. would go into Baghdad and people would be, you know, kind of throwing, you know, flowers and cheering them and welcoming them in. I mean, you know, Saddam Hussein was a brutal tyrant and they were happy to get rid of him. But the U.S. had been responsible for, you know, a dozen years of war and sanctions, which had killed hundreds of thousands. So, I mean, this is incredibly self-delusive. And the Arab world is even more upset now. This is the Jordan Times and an editorial saying, this is March 27th, 10 days after the war begun. President George Bush has already lost this war. He lost it with the first civilian casualty, which reminded the world that innocent people die in every war. He lost it again when it became even more apparent that surgical wars, smart bombs, don't exist. And the U.S. is now bombing apartment buildings and marketplaces in a desperate attempt to take Baghdad. Granted that things never going to go according to plan in any case, and especially in wars, it's still shocking how gross a miscalculation the Bush administration has made on the resistance that its troops would have encountered. Now, tactical victories on the ground will come at the prohibitive price of civilian casualties. It is the price that Washington cannot afford, but that it will have to pay. Washington's playing this very cleverly. The media keeps reporting, we'll never know how many Iraqis died. If you know anything about military history, that's frankly bullshit. I mean, military historians have gone back and figured out how many people died in the, you know, 100 years war. And demographers can tell you how many people lived in a particular city during the Middle Ages. And to suggest that you can't figure out how many people died in Baghdad in a 28-day war is simply preposterous. Bush is getting away with that here, and again, in the rest of the world, not so. Egypt, another one of America's client states, the second biggest recipient of U.S. foreign aid, also has really kind of found itself in a bind. There's a man who used to be in Hosni Mubarak's cabinet, Ahmed Kamal Abolmagdi, who very well-known Egyptian analyst, who was actually very much pro-American. But now, he says, and kind of speaking for the Egyptian elitist class, the Egyptian ruling class, says, George Bush is narrow-minded, uses words like narrow-minded, pathological, obstinate, and simplistic. This Egyptian he'd be the kind of guy who'd be on the talk shows like Kissinger or somebody like that. Says the war in Iraq is an act of a weak person who wants to show his toughness and, quite frankly, seems deranged. He continues, the United States has played a destructive role in the region by giving direct or indirect green lights to the Israeli government to do what it pleases. This is ruining Israel's future in the area. And whatever, even if all the Arabs sign up, this is a truce, this is a ceasefire, this is not a peace, he reiterates, it is not a peace. If you want peace, you must have genuine desire for peace. In addition to that, he finished, if the Iraq war comes to be seen as an American war against Islam, Bush will be to blame. He believes he was chosen by the Almighty to fulfill a Christian mission, or at least he was made to believe that by the people around him. Iran is an interesting case. Remember, we hated Iran in 1979 because they took hostages. Iran had been undergoing a reform process. And by the late 90s, it actually begun to elect a series of reformists, and there was a real struggle for power going on in Tehran. The indications were, by a lot of people who studied it, that within 5 or 10 years, Iran would probably have a reformist government and actually be, you know, kind of a power again in the Middle East, but potentially a fairly progressive, a relatively progressive power. Yet, when Bush talks after 9/11 in the State of the Union address in 2002, all those death threats I get, and it was only a matter of time, right? Bush, in his famous Axis of Evil speech, includes Iran, you know, which makes no sense whatsoever, because this is a country one would theoretically think you should be encouraging to reform, because isn't that what the world's about? We're moving toward democracy. That's what Wolfowitz and Pearl and all these guys always say. In fact, Bush was afraid of democracy, and American foreign policy in the 20th century has essentially been characterized by contempt and fear for nationalism and democracy, because nationalism and democracy indigenously mean that these people aren't going to do what American investors want them to do. And Iran's clearly a case of that. So Bush essentially undermined reformists in Iran. Now, Iran wasn't unhappy, obviously, to see Saddam Hussein taken down, since they had fought this brutal war in the 1980s. However, at a meeting with Syria's President Assad, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who is the leader of Iran, said, "America may be able to inflict damages to the region in the short term, but resistance of the regional nations will finally inflict the biggest blow to America and will culminate in the fall of America's superpower image." He might be right. He might be right. I mean, it's way too early to say that, but he very well might be right. Another, the largest Muslim country in the world. It's not in the Middle East. It's actually Indonesia. President of Indonesia, Megawati Sukarno-Putri, who's actually an ally of D.C., said that U.S. policy amounted to the law of the jungle. And he said the powerful country feels it has the right to exert its will upon the weak. This reminds me of the Malian dialogues. If you remember Thucydides talking about the Peloponnesian War, the envoys from Athens go to this small island called Milos, and they say, "We're going to take it over." And the Malians say, "You can't take it over." And they laugh, and they said, "Of course we can. We're bigger and stronger than you." And the epigraph that Thucydides uses is, "The strong do as they will, and the weak submit as they must." And I think that's essentially how the Bush people sees the world. Finally, kind of as an epigraph to this part, you know, America's role in the Arab world, America's strongest ally in this region is Hosni Mubarak, who had the, you know, fairly easy judgment to point out that this war could create, as he put it, 100 bin Ladens. That's, you don't need to be a genius to figure it out. The CIA had constantly been warning Bush that this war, rather than be an attack on terrorism, could very likely lead to more terror activities. At the same time, the CIA said, despite our, what were we, orange alerts or whatever the color of the day was, that they didn't expect terrorism to occur in the near term, in the short term. So why is John Ashcroft putting us on, you know, super double secret orange alert at the same time that the CIA is saying we're actually very safe, okay? The Patriot Act is, you know, I mean, we all know that. The Patriot Act is about suppressing dissent at home and keeping Arabs and Muslims detained and things like that. It has nothing to do with national security whatsoever. Okay, this kind of lack of credibility in the Arab world has continued today, and we see it quite clearly. In Cairo, one of the television commentators very pithily, when the war ended and we saw everybody come out, you know, and they were cheering, right? They were happy. They were liberated. Said it is only the thieves and the looters who are celebrating. And I think we've seen that quite clearly now. The U.S. finds itself kind of in a real bind in Iraq. I mean, we've seen the lootings of the museums, which they've been warned against. The only places protected were the oil ministry. Now the U.S. has to deal with kind of rebuilding Iraq, reconstruction, right? The cost of that could be quite enormous. But politically, the U.S. now faces four forces in Iraq. The Shia majority. Saddam Hussein was a Sunni. Saddam Hussein was actually secular. So you have the Shia majority, the Sunnis, the Kurds, and of course, overseeing this whole thing is the only group capable of functioning as a government, and that's the Ba'ath Party. Now, they keep talking about de-Ba'athification. If anything, you know anything about Germany after World War II, they had show trials in Nuremberg, and they executed 20-some or 30-some German leaders. Okay? However, outside of that, the Nazi infrastructure remained in power in Germany because that was the only group that the U.S. considered trustworthy to maintain a political economy of liberal capitalism. Within Iraq, and you know, I'm certainly no expert on Iraqi politics, the only people who know how to do anything are Ba'athists because that place was so state-controlled. They're going to have to work with the Ba'ath Party. And the Ba'ath Party will remain in power, and they will have the same connections and the same pipelines and the same corruption they did before. Meanwhile, as we saw the other day, millions of Shia are congregating, and they're protesting, and they're putting their own people in charge of cities as mayors and so forth. And they're saying, thank you for getting rid of Saddam, now get the hell out of town. That's not going to end anytime soon. All right, so you have the Shia fighting the Sunni, the Ba'ath probably trying to hold on to power. Then in the north you have the Kurdish minority. The Kurds are the largest ethnic group in the world without any kind of national state. The Kurds have taken over oil-rich areas. Turkey is threatening to come in, okay? Because Turkey treats its Kurds probably worse than Iraq did. The United States finds itself now caught in this kind of Scylla and Charybdis, where it has to allegedly protect this ethnic minority, which had been persecuted by Saddam Hussein, and at the same time navigate the shoals of this ally. Turkey is considered, you know, it's a member of NATO and considered probably the most viable democratic state in the region. Whenever I think about the Kurds, Henry Kissinger in 1975 had been supporting the Kurds against the Ba'ath Party. He'd been funneling aid to them to overthrow the Ba'athists and realized it was wasted money, and he withdrew all this aid from them. And Saddam goes in and gasses like 25,000 Kurds, and somebody asks Kissinger if he feels bad about it, and Kissinger says covert operations is not missionary work. So this is the way the U.S. looks at the Kurds. On a larger level, the two biggest stories, I think, more recently have been Syria, of course. Bush floated a trial balloon. We're going to go into Syria. That was shot down. He knows better. And I think that, you know, as I said at the very beginning, the larger imperial agenda has been put on the shelf. I had really thought that Syria, Iran, it would be kind of a domino thing. That's not going to happen now. I really, really doubt that's going to happen. I'd be surprised if it did. Another issue, though, that we haven't heard much about, which I think is actually more frightening, and Korea comes to play here, is the United States has demonstrated that it's a major power, that it's willing to inflict incredible damage upon small countries which don't go along with what the U.S. says it should do. All right, what's the solution to that? They can't develop conventional armies. They could fly planes into buildings, but that really, in terms of changing strategy, doesn't do anything. So the only alternative they now have is what I call, you know, the Pyongyang alternative, which is going nuclear. So what we have here, because the disparity in war power is so great between the U.S. and all these other countries, is, I think, the potential for a new nuclear arms race, something that we haven't seen probably since the 70s or early 80s, the early Reagan years, because countries like Tehran, I mean, if I were running Tehran right now, I would accelerate my nuclear program because, you know, I want deterrence. And then I would tell everybody I'm accelerating my nuclear program, and I would tell them I reprocessed 8,000 fuel rods. Because this is the only way you're going to be able to say to the U.S., don't mess with us. You know, Saddam Hussein, obviously, by disarming before he was attacked, didn't set a very good example for that. Okay. The second part I want to talk about in this larger theme of cracks in the empire, and I'll try to kind of speed it up here, is what I call cracks or fissures in the ruling class. And I have so much good stuff here, I'll try to be quick with it. One thing that was really striking about this war before it began and even afterward was the intensity of opposition to Bush from the largest and most influential power brokers in the United States. Who opposed this war? Who opposed this war? You know, the media would have it, you know, it was a bunch of hippies in the street kind of thing. And you saw the way the media projected this and, you know, people vomiting at the federal building in San Francisco, stupid stuff like that, you know, blocking traffic in the most liberal zip codes in America. But in fact, the most powerful forces arrayed against the war actually were guys in three-piece suits or guys wearing stars on their shoulders. Henry Kissinger. God, I hate being saying nice things about Kissinger. It really bothers me, you know. Remember when Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize, Paul Krasner said, this is the death of satire, so... But even Kissinger, Dr. Kissinger, said that the groundbreaking status of a unilateral attack would breach international codes about using force only in self-defense, and it would require meticulous planning to counter the skepticism of allies and the hostility of foes. This is Kissinger. He says, because of the precedent-setting nature of the war, its outcome will determine the way U.S. actions will be viewed far more than the way we entered it. Who else opposed this war? Jim Baker. Jim Baker, the architect of the first Gulf War. Baker said it would be very risky and expensive to mount an invasion of Iraq, especially if the White House decides to go it alone. Baker said, and this is last summer, although the United States could certainly succeed, we should try our best not to have to go it alone, and the president should reject the advice of those who counsel doing so. The costs in all areas will be much greater, as will the political risks, both domestic and international, if we end up going it alone or with only one or two other countries. That's Jim Baker, who was George Sr.'s, George 41, Secretary of State. In a speech at Tufts University, the only public statement he made throughout this entire crisis, George Herbert Walker Bush said that the United States should only intervene multilaterally and with UN sanction. After that, he went quiet. However, in addition to Baker, a lot of his other people who he was associated with did not remain so quiet. Maureen Dowd, wonderful columnist for the New York Times. She's highly recommended. Maureen Dowd talked about this, and she said, a Republican with close ties to the Bush inner circle said today that Mr. Scowcroft would not have made his warnings so public without knowledge from the first President Bush. What was she talking about? Brent Scowcroft, who was the National Security Advisor and one of the architects of the first Gulf War, was one of the largest critics. Scowcroft published op-eds in all the major newspapers. What did he say? Saddam Hussein is unlikely to do anything risky. He is not a threat to American interest. He's not going to hand his weapons over to terrorists because he needs them himself in case he gets attacked. In fact, he destroyed them, which was even, for the U.S., it was the best case scenario. Bush is a genius. He gets this guy to destroy all his weapons and disarm before he attacks him. Maybe the guy has some on the ball that we just don't see or something like that. But this is Scowcroft. Scowcroft says, given Saddam's aggressive regional ambitions as well as his ruthlessness and unpredictability, it may be wise at some point to remove him. Whether and when that point should come ought to depend on overall American national security priorities. And today, our preeminent security priority, underscored repeatedly by the president, is the war on terrorism. And an attack on Iraq at this time would seriously jeopardize, if not destroy, the global counter-terrorist campaign we have undertaken. Scowcroft went on to say that it would exacerbate the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, too. Lawrence Eagleburger, who actually was the last Secretary of State under Bush 41, just a few days ago said, I swear to God, I'm not making this up, if Bush goes into Syria, he should be impeached. Lawrence Eagleburger said that. It wasn't just diplomats. General Wesley Clark, first in his class at West Point, NATO commander, became an outspoken critic of the war. Clark actually quite amazingly said that the United States was assuming the role of a colonial power in the Middle East. Okay? Did you hear Ted Kennedy say that? Russ Feingold, Barbara Boxer, Nancy Pelosi, Tom Daschle? I never heard any of them say that. Wesley Clark did. Anthony Zinni, who for a while was Bush's envoy to the Middle East and was a Marine general, Zinni said, I'm not sure which planet they live on because it isn't the one that I travel in. When people said that they had to do regime change, Zinni said, God help us if we think this transition will occur easily. This is a guy who was a special envoy to the Middle East. Wesley Clark in October predicted the war. He's really quite on the target. He said, the war will probably be very quick, last a couple weeks at most, easy military victory. But then, even under the most optimistic scenarios, the troubles are likely to begin. Food distribution will break down. Healthcare will break down. There will be violence and revenge in the streets as Saddam's secret police melt away. Despite efforts to maintain order, there will be uprisings, as in Basra at the end of the Gulf War. The popular violence will be widespread and targeted on those associated with Saddam's regime. There's a long-term risk from a devastating defeat of Saddam that is extremely dangerous. And this is more critical from Wesley Clark. A deepening of the Arab sense of humiliation across the region. They will view the American victory as a reimposition of colonialism. This perception is not helped by those who say we can pay for the war by taking 1 million barrels of Iraqi oil a day. That kind of talk just confirms the mistaken idea that America is doing all this only for oil. Actually, I agree with that. I don't think this was a war about oil. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Another danger is that Iraq could become a battleground of fundamentalism. There is little that American soldiers can do to prevent this. It will depend on establishing quickly an effective Iraqi government. Although, as I'm sure you've seen, sending Franklin Graham there with Bibles is probably going to be the answer to all this. If you haven't seen Billy Graham's son, who said that Islam is an evil religion, is heading down to Baghdad with a ministry of Christian Bibles. In 1948, when they were debating whether to recognize Israel at the UN, the Israeli and Palestinian representatives got into a fight, and the American ambassador to the UN, Warren Austin, said, "Can't you guys settle this in a good Christian manner?" So as we can see, and I could go on at great length, the people who ran the first Gulf War and the people charged with fighting this war were against it. Now, the Pentagon kept leaking documents. I mean, it's very difficult for active duty military people to speak out. The fact of the matter is, however, that people like Zinni and Wesley Clark and Joseph Hoare, who was a Marine Captain in the first war, and Norman Schwarzkopf and John Chalish Kavili, and Colin Powell, for that matter, who really did a 180. He really was spineless. But essentially, every military commander from the first Gulf War publicly rebuked the president. And more importantly, his father made one public statement throughout the whole period and then remained silent. And all reports indicated that Bush Sr. never changed his mind, that he remained opposed to this after it began and remains that way today, to the point where Eagleburger can say Bush should be impeached if he goes into Syria, which is, again, really quite remarkable. The CIA also, there's a wonderful story in The Independent, I think it was in Yesterday or Today, but it said a war based on pack of lies. And essentially, MI5 and the CIA are furious at Blair and Bush because they were set up. Bush said, "We have definitive evidence that, you know, he has nuclear weapons, definitive evidence of weapons of mass destruction, that he's harboring terrorists, you know, the whole thing." The CIA has been butchered, and they've been made to look bad, with good reason, since 9/11. And they're trying to clean up their act. I'm defending the CIA now, so you guys can all check me out afterward. Bush has set them up. And so what we're seeing now, and this is something to look out for, it's really boring stuff, but it's really critically important. Rumsfeld has announced he wants to reorganize the Pentagon. He wants to reorganize the Department of Defense. Harry Truman tried to do this after World War II, and something called the Revolt of the Admirals occurred. Rumsfeld essentially is going to try to get rid of all of the Clinton and Powell people and put his own people in charge. Now, as Bill Clinton learned when he tried to bring gays into the military, one group that you run great danger of when you take on is the military, because there is no group in America, perhaps except for, you know, the senior citizens in ARP, who have the political power of the Pentagon. And Rumsfeld, believe it or not, is more despised than Clinton. Civil-military relations today are at their worst point since the Vietnam era, when I studied it, and in fact they were dreadful because everybody hated McNamara. I mean, if you look at Rumsfeld, he's morphing into McNamara. It's kind of funny. I've never seen him together, or maybe, I don't know, if one can drink when the other one speaks, that kind of thing. But civil-military relations are really at a nadir, and this is something to look out for, too. And again, fissures in the ruling class. Now, the third point, and I'll try to be quick with this because it's something that's still in play and I haven't quite been able to figure it out, is that the ruling class itself is deeply divided. And by this element of the ruling class, I mean the financial people. We've gotten to the point now where, God forbid, that, you know, we'd be a lot better off if the bankers and generals were making policies on war and peace than these guys in the White House. The world financial community was overwhelmingly opposed to American policy in the Middle East. Not for any altruistic reasons or because they liked Saddam Hussein or anything like that, because they saw that this could have catastrophic consequences for the global economy. At the same time, the United States has undertaken actions economically which threaten its own hegemony, its own power. First of all, the cost of the war. We don't know what it's going to be. Obviously, it's going to be fairly serious. Bush kept saying we're going to have Congress voted $80 billion for the war. Okay, that was $80 billion for that month of the war. All right, the military budget last year was $400 billion. In the past decade, they spent many trillions. Okay, so all those cruise missiles and all that other stuff, that was already paid for. That $80 billion was a complementary appropriation. All right? Now, think of the cost of occupation. We keep hearing about Halliburton and Brown and Root, and we've done some stuff here. Bechtel. I'm used to it, you know, after the KPFT battles, this is nothing. So. I didn't realize Dwayne Bradley and Otis were back here shooting at me, so. The costs of the war are going to be quite significant, and the costs of Reconstruction are going to be great. The cost of Reconstruction, too, because when they talk about Reconstruction, you know, you get this idea that they're talking about, you know, baby milk and food and things like that. 80% of Reconstruction costs are militarily directed. Building bases, building an infrastructure for military occupation. 80% of that goes to the military. So when Halliburton and Kellogg Brenner Root and Bechtel, I used to say Schlumberger, but they're not going to get a cut of it now. When they get money, it's going to be basically for military. Kellogg Brown and Root's the biggest builder of kind of portable military installations in the world. They're all over, like Afghanistan and Kosovo. They'll be in Iraq, where they build these kind of prefab camps where you just put them up and boom. And there's going to be a long occupation with a lot of forces there. So the costs of this war are going to be obviously quite significant. Now, so the U.S. is going to be putting a lot of revenue out, right? They're going to be spending a lot of money. So when you want to balance the budget, what's the answer to that? A $750 billion tax cut, right? Some of us will get like $1,000, $1,500 out of it. Working class folks will get $100. I'm assuming no one in this room is at that level where you're going to get $30,000 out of it. If there is, you can create an endowed share for me at UH so I don't have to work so hard. So obviously, a tax cut combined with the cost of the war for all of us is going to lead to real issues, okay? Certain industries are going to be hurt. The airlines have already felt the brunt of it. The airline industry has lost or will lose between 70 and 100,000 jobs. Being in Houston, you know, obviously all of us probably have contact with somebody who's felt that or is worried about it. Ford Motor Company recently announced a 20% cut in costs because sales have gone down. Generally, the economy is fairly stagnant right now. Same thing's happening in Britain, by the way. Britain has accumulated a $12 billion pound, which is about $19 billion. That's B, billion, deficit because of the war in Iraq. The economic outlook is quite frightening. The IMF and the World Bank recently did a study. So I've got to favorably quote so far Henry Kissinger, Jim Baker, the CIA, and now the IMF and World Bank. So perhaps I can get a job consulting for them. Because I'm being serious here. These guys are so bad, I mean it. I would rather have the generals and bankers making policy than Wolfowitz, Pearl, and Cheney. Because these guys are worldly. I mean, bankers and generals have a sense of the world. Bush is, I mean, he's never traveled anywhere. He's never done anything. He doesn't know the world. And these guys really are very insular. And it's really quite frightening, and then they have all these religious crazies, and it's really, I'm serious, quite chilling. And so, you know, financial people see the world, and I mean, what they do is really reprehensible. And in the long run, it may be like choosing between, you know, AIDS and cancer, you know. We either have the U.S. come in and, you know, destroy us, or we just slowly get, you know, thrown into debt and die that way. But there is actually a long tradition of kind of liberal politics in the world financial community because they understand that reform is essential. I mean, most reform in American history, hate to break it to people in the streets, has actually come from the top down. I mean, basically, capitalists decide, hey, we better clean the system up. If not, you know, people are going to be pissed off and they might come after us, so they create reform. The Progressive Era occurred that way. The New Deal occurred that way. The Great Society occurred that way. Those were top-down reform movements as ways to forestall any kind of like redistribution of wealth or effective radical programmatic change. And so these guys understand that. So what we have right now actually is the potential for world reform. The IMF recently put out a report posing a lot of problems that this war has created. First, the U.S. is trying to shut the U.N. out of Reconstruction. It's trying to monopolize the commercial contracts that will go for Reconstruction. Secondly, there's a round of trade negotiations going on with the IMF in Doha, Qatar, I guess it used to be Qatar. There's a real sense now, and I talked about this earlier, with regard to the U.S. abandoning the globalization mission, that rather than have these multilateral, supranational organizations, the U.S. will now undergo a series of bilateral agreements. So the kind of multinationalism that every president, Republican, Democrat, has accepted may, in fact, be gutted by these people in favor of the kind of, you know, kind of, I call it the Tony Soprano approach of helping out your friends and whacking your enemies. And I really think that the approach to France is that way. The anti-French hysteria is really quite disturbing. You know, if you have any sense of history, the U.S. would not have become independent without the support of the French Navy. France went into debt. I mean, Louis the 15th, 16th lost his head, and the revolution occurred because France was so deeply in debt from helping the Americans. If you know anything about currency, and that's a difficult subject, I'm not exactly an expert at it, but the dollar has been consistently falling against the euro. The euro has recently reached a four-year high. Middle Eastern states have started to use the euro rather than the dollar. The dollar has been the world's currency, first under the Bretton Woods and gold standard system until 1973, and since then on a more floating system, but still the dollar has been the world's reserve currency. When people start using euros instead of dollars, then that can lead to all kinds of consequences. We'll have an excess of dollars. All right, we have a Fed right now which has refused to inflate currency. I mean, interest rates, you know, cannot go down any further. If the United States is going to pay for Reconstruction by itself, okay, if the dollar doesn't remain viable with regard to the euro, then when third world countries or other countries decide to borrow money, where are they going to borrow it from? Well, the U.S. is going to have to inflate its currency at some point. It's inevitable. So what you're going to see is the central banks of places like France and Germany, not Russia, but I think Russia actually is playing this fairly smart too, will start to become places to go for third world lenders, all right, which I think was going to lead to higher interest rates in the United States, which is going to lead to inflation. I mean, even though interest rates on houses, you know, on housing and cars, I mean, you know, credit card rates have actually been going up. The U.S. Has this new model for economic growth, so it's likely to challenge the power of the IMF and World Bank. Now, you know, I'm all for challenging the power of the IMF and World Bank. It's what many of us have been trying to do for years. I just don't want the Bush people doing it because they're going to be coming at it from a quite different way. And finally, payback as hell. I think there's a good chance that the U.S. will go after countries which didn't support it. France, obviously, China, Russia, and so forth. Okay? So this is the kind of larger outlook that I foresee. Now, to some extent, it's not terribly optimistic. I mean, we've just undergone a war which devastated a country, and we have the U.S. acting as the world's only superpower. However, at the same time, I think there are opportunities now for a change in the way the world operates, for a political realignment. France and Germany haven't backed down. The UN may finally be getting its backbone up again with regard to reconstruction. The U.S. has alienated everybody in the world. It couldn't get the votes of Cameroon and Guinea. I can't say that enough. The ruling elite, the Pentagon and the bankers, are really upset. Bush, Scowcroft, Eagleburger, Kissinger, all these guys. When you have all of these guys arrayed against you and you're one of them, I mean, this is like a family fight. It's kind of like the Sopranos whacking, you know, somebody who's informed on them or something like that. It's really quite serious to see that kind of, I've never in my life seen any kind of deep division within the ruling elite like I do today. And then finally, and probably most importantly in the long run, and something that we have to kind of keep our eyes on, is that the economic consequences of this could be quite serious. And within that line, I want to finish with one of my favorite quotes by Dwight Eisenhower. Totally hypocritical quote, because this is the guy who overthrew Guatemala and Iran and everything else, but it's a wonderful quote. He meant well. And he said, every gun, he's speaking in 1953, and actually called for a detente. This is after Stalin died, and he wanted a detente with the Soviet Union. And he made a speech called A Chance for Peace. And in it, he has some very beautiful words that I think are really timely today, just as the quotes by John Quincy Adams and Robert Taft, I think, were very timely at the start. And this may give us some cause for hope. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this, a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete highway. We pay for a single fighter with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We paid for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This, I repeat, is the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.